Stay with us now as 98.7 WFMT brings you Writers on the Record, a monthly series presenting interviews with authors conducted before a live audience. It's a unique collaborative effort of Chicago Magazine, 98.7 WFMT, and Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Water Works. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Louise Erdrich, author of The Painted Drum. In this, her 11th novel, she weaves an intricate tale of troubled, tangled lives, mixing Native American stories from the Northern Plains with events past and present. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Here is Victoria Lautman.
Thank you. Who whistled? That was good. I like that. We'll have to add that whistle every time. Welcome to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, who is myself. This is a monthly free author interview series, which is co-sponsored by Chicago Magazine, WFMT Radio, set here at Looking Glass Theater, where currently we are on the half-built stage of a production that is opening at the end of October called Manuscript Found in Saragossa. It's, I'm sure, going to be fantastic judging by this set, so the people on the radio can't see it, but boy, is it cool. Isn't it? Clap if you like the set. Yes.
Cool.
Good. Thank you. There are going to be questions at the end of this broadcast, and we also sell the books. Barbara's bookstore is selling the books outside. And we will be taking a break in about a half an hour. But anyway, you know, that's all boring stuff. The important thing is my guest here, Louise Erdrich, who was paid a nickel as she was growing up by her father every time she wrote a story. He would give her a nickel. And apparently, he didn't realize that this was going to engender the kind of creative outpouring that it did, and it made a lot more financial sense, apparently, than having a lemonade stand. Because when you count up what Louise Erdrich has produced, it's just phenomenal. 10 novels, starting with Love Medicine, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award back in 1984. Her first book that was published in 1983 was a book of poetry, and she went on to write two more books of poetry. There are 4 children's books, including The Birch Bark House, The Game of Silence, 2 nonfiction books, including The Blue Jays Dance, and 1 book, The Crown of Columbus, which was a collaboration with Michael Doris. Without any further ado, we are going to be talking to Louise Erdrich about her new book, The Painted Drum. Thank you, Louise, for being here.
Oh, thank you.
It's a fantastic
book. Thank you, Victoria.
Book.
It's great to be here. I love coming to Chicago. It's right
we gave
down
you a
the
big start,
and
didn't we?
Absolutely.
Chicago Magazine.
Home of Studs Terkel. I always think of it that way.
Maybe. That's nice. Well, oh, come on. Okay,
Yeah.
We'd like you to think of it now as the home of Writers on the Record with the Kyle Lautman.
And I was
but
just
thank
getting
you.
To
great.
That. But the applause stopped me just for a moment. May you have as wonderful and long a career.
I mean,
you
well,
know, just great that he's still writing and still, his books are still out there.
His books are still out there, but we are here to talk about you. And she's already
yes.
trying to, like, remove attention from herself because she's so shy
attention
and
immediately.
Self-deprecating. The Painted Drum, which is bringing you here today, and I realize I could describe this book, but every time I set out to talk about what a book is about, it becomes long-winded, pedantic, and boring. And so why shouldn't you tell us what the book is about?
Oh, okay. The book's about the heroism of little girls, I think. And I didn't know that when I first started to write it. I thought it was a dysfunctional love story. But it is that, too.
Yeah, it's got that
yeah,
in there,
it's got
definitely.
There, yeah. But it turns on several acts of self-sacrifice between older siblings and younger siblings. And that sort of love and generosity of spirit is, I think, what informs the book and what it's really about.
Now, that's really interesting, because asking you to describe the book, you don't actually tell us the story. You tell us what the themes are, which I think is a very writerly thing to do. And I would have probably started with, well, first this happens and that happens. There's 3 sections narrated by several different people, and there's a drum.
Right. See, I don't want to ruin anything about the story, because I don't like it when a review tells you the whole story and then says, oh, sorry, I had to reveal that, because that's the reader's experience, you know.
So anything I say today, will you be bothered about
if I talk about specific characters? No.
Well, then let's just start by saying that the first voice that we hear, it's set in the present. It's set in New Hampshire. Faye Travers. Who lives with her mother, Elsie. Faye is, like you, a woman in her early 50s. Not like you. She's a former druggie.
Probably not.
I'm assuming.
She gives herself a lawnmower for her 50th birthday, not like me.
You never did that. Okay.
No.
But she does have 33 bound books of what she describes as bad poetry, also not like you, but a lot of
journals. That's like me.
She's a writer, yeah. And this is an unusual character for you. She speaks with a voice that's very direct, very cut down, very like pared to the bone, I think. And Faye sets the story in motion. The book begins in a cemetery for children. And she is ruminating on the fact that the road that takes her home to Revival Road, you can go two ways. And she thinks about how you can make the slightest of choices and end up in happiness or despair.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things in that first paragraph, practically, the book, I think set up the trajectory of what's about to come.
Right. And they're really, the beginning of the Inferno is really where I went for this beginning. Halfway through life's, the middle passage of life, you know, that's where she is. She's thinking that these little choices shouldn't mean so much, and yet they begin to mean so much to her. And as she takes one side of the road or another, it's also, you know, she's in Frost Country, she's in New Hampshire. She veers into a relationship. She veers into a set of circumstances that will cause her to, will really force her to relive a very crucial time in her childhood. And by breaking through that stasis that she's been held in, she'll be able to go forward.
Everything in this book that happens, and which she's sort of referring to also in a way, is every little thing leads to the next, the interconnectedness of things.
That's
and
right.
There is so much misery and anguish and death in the book.
Oh, great.
But it's very uplifting. In a good way. In a good way.
In a good way.
And it kind of turns out all right at the end. I'm not going to give you the details. But I have to say that the first death in the book is a murder. A murder, this is a terrible pun. I just thought of it. A murder most foul.
Right.
It's a raven.
You know, yes, I didn't even think of it that way, but that is definitely it.
Oh, I thought that was really important.
It's very important.
And you didn't even know.
No, but I didn't. I thought of it as setting into motion everything else, but I was, it's like the Ancient Mariner, isn't it? It's where, you know, I don't want to give too many literary references. I don't even, you know, it's not about other books, but the murder of the raven sets everything else into motion.
Well, that's how I felt, but I'm sorry to hear you didn't. You can use that now.
But I can always. I love to have, you know, that there's a revelation left is very good.
I got a few more here.
Good.
Well, I think what's critical about that is that from that moment of this raven being killed by the character Davan Eyck, I keep wanting to call him Jan van Eyck, who's a 16th century Netherlandish painter. Anyway, that there's this buildup of one thing after the next that leads to another several deaths, that leads to the character of Faye going to the home of an Indian trader, former Indian trader, Truett. What's his name?
John Parker. Tatro.
Why am I getting so confused about
Tatro.
This? John Tatro, yeah. Right. And it's that moment of going to the house, of looking around, sifting through the detritus of other people, which she points out, Faye, to us, that the idea of going to be an estate appraiser is actually so not an Ojibwe thing to do.
Right.
You're not allowed to put your hands onto objects of the dead. And it's showing us that she is really pretty much, it's not even that she's rejected her one-quarter Indianness. She's just she just doesn't care, basically.
Right.
Her job and her mother's job of going to these estates, I think, is a really interesting component of the book. And actually, the first thing that I think you're going to read is about that. One of the things that she finds while she's hunting through, not the Tatro household, but one of the other estate sales. And I think it sort of sets up this character for us.
Oh, good. I'll read it. It's a little piece that it does illuminate something about what I think being an estate salesperson must be like. You know, I'm not one, but I've been to a lot of great rummage sales. I had to do research all my life with my mom. So this is a moment when, as she says, some estates come to life and others don't. Some holdings have little personality, others much. For instance, there is a moment I think of still, one I nearly missed. Years ago, I opened a small wooden chest containing what appeared to be handkerchiefs wrapped in tissue paper, only handkerchiefs, bearing the owner's initials LMB. I was about to empty the box and scatter its contents among the linens when I noticed a label. Pinned to each cotton, lawn, lace-trimmed or embroidered handkerchief, I realized, was a carefully cut piece of paper. Of course, I examined the papers. Each was a label, with a date inked in ladylike script. A name or names were written. And then occasions. Teddy's christening. Vanetta and John Howard's wedding. And then Teddy's funeral. Brother Admantine's wake. First opera, La Traviata. Wedding, broken arm. And far down at the bottom, perhaps, the first such kept handkerchief. And the author of the collection. A child's small square of fabric clumsily sewn with the initials and labeled My Mother's Funeral. I remember sitting with the handkerchiefs belonging to LMB as the rest of the work of pricing and sorting swirled around me. Here was a box containing a woman's lifetime of tears. I passed through several stages of emotion. The first was elation at the novelty of such an odd Victorian idea and the urge to show the box and its contents to my partners. Next, I was swept through with such irritation for this evidence of outrageous thrift that I had a rare thought. I almost never think of non-Indians as white. After all, my own skin is pale, but I experienced a sudden bolt of prejudice that surprised me. Just like a white lady, so stingy with her tears she kept them. Then I recovered myself and sat further, still holding the box, which was very light, the wood dry, old varnished pine, and turning over one and the next handkerchief, Theodore's precious birth, Aunt Lilac's deathbed supper. What was a deathbed supper? Cousin Franklin's wedding to Mildred Vost, more funerals. As the other workers tackled the next room, I was left alone with the box in my lap. And it was then, sitting with LMB's sorrows and joys, that my own eyes filled with tears. There weren't many. I am not the crying sort anymore. So when I did feel that swell of sadness, I reached immediately for one of the handkerchiefs, dabbed my eyes dry, and added my own tears to the box. Then I closed the box. I knew what had happened was exactly right. Tears shed for LMB, I might have written on a scrap of paper. I'd have to buy the box myself now, but that seemed the proper close to the collection.
Louise Erdrich reading from The Painted Drum. I love that. I love that description in the book because the character of Faye is so unsentimental, really, and so sort of cut and dried and contained and defended. And it was a moment where she seems to let down her defenses for a bit. Not long after that, she discovers the drum for which the book is named. And boy, does that really set things going in the book. She steals something. She decides to take something home with her. She is not even sure why she's embarking on this. And it's at that moment when really the drum's power begins to take over the book.
Right, right. And when the drum's history begins to unfold because, of course, she decides to bring it back. It's connected with her background, as little as she wants to even think about or admit it. It is connected. It makes a connection for her, and she brings it back, and then other voices begin to tell her the story of that drum.
Now, there's a lot in the book that is really particularly Ojibwean about how a drum is made and why it's decorated. And Elsie, Faye's mother, who really is the bridge to the kind of native way of life that they have both given up. They're living in New Hampshire. They're not connected any longer. And even Elsie, who remembers a lot of these things from her own upbringing, she keeps saying, well, you know, that drum, what is it she says? That drum is just as alive as a set of human bones. Words that become very important later on in the book. Mm-hmm. Yet she denies that that's the way she feels about it.
Right.
Yet she asks very particular questions. Was it painted? What color? Was it dressed? How? And those specific questions lead those of us who have no connection to an Indian drum into the kind of power that these ritual objects have. Later in the book, when we find out how the drum is constructed, the type of wood that has to be used, all of these things really add layer upon layer to this thing. You're very careful when you write those things, though, about what you're revealing. You don't want to reveal things that aren't already in the public domain, right?
Right. I have in the back a note to say exactly that. I relied on written sources for most of it because I don't want to do anything that would inadvertently give away some secret part of knowledge or something that people don't want out there. But this drum I did want to portray because drums are pretty much a stereotypical object associated with Native people and often just treated as though they're things. But to people who are in the tradition, they are alive. And for instance, this one, it's kept with, as Elsie says, it has to be fed. Water has to be kept near it. You keep tobacco to feed it. You know, it has some spirit, and that's why she takes it. It has a sound that she can't explain, and it continues to sound for her. Now, if you have drums around, you know that they do sound according to the change of pressure in a room, or even the another object striking us in the other side of the room. But to her, this is just a remarkable thing, and she keeps it very carefully.
She's not quite sure why she even removes it and why it's having this effect on her, and it's not till the end of the book that you really realize how the drum is really a character in itself.
It is. Drum is a character. That's what you learn after reading the middle of the book. It will have effect on other people.
Now, Faye is an unusual character for you in general. I mean, just her voice alone in the book, and sometimes a sentence is a word or two long. And those of us who have read a lot of your work are used to much more kind of effusive language from characters. I know that she gave you a hard time. I mean, you couldn't even name her until a certain part in this book.
That's because, true, yeah.
Why particularly with Faye?
I think that she had thoughts like mine, and I haven't had a character who wasn't sort of taking over my brain, but I was actually using parts of my own experience, thoughts, things I'd even written. For instance, the part about ravens, which forms, I think, the beginning of her sensibility in the book, her ideas about what they represent for her, were thoughts that I had. I watched them, and I've had some sort of relationship with ravens or crows, I suppose you'd say.
You had a pet named Mab.
We did. My daughter Palace's pet crow, and we raised this crow, and we did a good job of it because Mab did return to her crow group, her flock. Or I think they're called a murder of crows, but we don't really want to say that. But So this crow fell in love with us as a family. So it was a very tender but really poignant relationship.
Well, I thought it was interesting, not to go back to this, you know, raven murder early in the book,
right.
But that you really do exact some specific retribution on the character that kills that raven. I mean, you do get to kind of indulge your characters. You have so much compassion for them, like even the rotten ones. You know, you've always seemed to manage to find a kernel of something redeeming, but you do kill that guy off.
They do.
You're angry at him
off
for killing that raven.
Yes.
When we move to this, there's three separate sections in the book. The second section really takes over in a completely different voice. We're going to, this is when, after the drum is stolen and brought home, and Elsie is confronted with it, and they decide they have to almost repatriate the drum. By that time, Faye has decided, well, I'm not really stealing it, because really it was stolen by Tatro. This drum should never have passed outside of the clan. And so they embark on a journey to try and reconnect with a past that they've sort of lost. Then the book shifts into another voice of Bernard
Chauhanneau. And he is the one person who has known how the drum was made and known everything about the drum from the very beginning, because he, as a young man, lived with his grandfather. So that he's heard the stories, he's known the people, and he remembers the songs and all the connections with the drum. And the drum really does start to come alive, not because, you know, it's actually a living object. It's also because the people have the songs and the people dream around it, and it begins to bring people into a healing group. And so then the drum gains more of its life from the people around it and from their songs.
Well, before we take the break, I want you to read from the section called The Shawl. It is the second section, I think, of the book.
Right.
This was a short story before it was in the book, and we're going back now to probably early in the 20th century, aren't we?
Yes, this is right around the turn of the last century, and it's Bernard remembering it's actually his father's childhood, but it's also a story that is based on an old story, and I always like to remember an elder from Onigaming who had an experience very much like this. Among the Anishinaabeg on the road where I live, it is told how a woman loved a man other than her husband and went off into the bush and bore his child. Her name was Anaquat, and like her namesake the cloud, she was changeable. She was moody and sullen one moment, threatening, her lower lip jutting and her eyes flashing, filled with storms. The next, she would shake her hair over her face, blow it out straight in front of her, and make her children scream with laughter. For she also had two children by her husband, one a yearning boy of 5 years, and the other a capable daughter of 9. When Anaquat brought the new baby out of the trees that autumn, the older girl was like a second mother, even waking in the night to clean the baby and nudge it to her mother's breast. Anaquat slept through its cries, hardly woke. It wasn't that she didn't love her baby. No, it was quite the opposite. She loved it too much, the way she loved its father and not her husband. This passion ate away at her, and her feelings were unbearable. If she could have thrown off that wrong-hearted love, she would have. But the thought of the man who lived across the lake was with her always. She became a gray sky, stared monotonously at the walls, and sometimes wept into her hands for hours at a time. Soon, she couldn't rise to cook or keep the cabin neat. And it was too much for the girl, who curled up each night exhausted in her red and brown plaid shawl and slept until the husband had to wake the girl to awaken her mother, for he was afraid of his wife's bad temper, and it was he who roused her into anger by the sheer fact that he was himself and not the other. At last, even though he loved Anaquat, the husband had to admit that their life together was no good anymore. So it was he who sent for the other man's uncle. In those days, our people lived widely scattered along the shores and in the islands, even out in the plains. There were no roads then, just trails, though we had horses and wagons and for the winter sleds. When the uncle came around to fetch Anaquat, in his wagon fitted out with sled runners, it was very hard. For she and her husband had argued right up to the last about the children, argued fiercely, until the husband had finally given in. He turned his face to the wall and did not move to see the daughter, whom he treasured, sit down beside her mother, wrapped in her plaid robe in the wagon bed. They left right away with their bundles and sacks, not bothering to heat up the stones to warm their feet. The father had stopped his ears, so he did not hear his son cry out, when he suddenly understood that he would be left behind. As the uncle slapped the reins and the horse lurched forward, the boy tried to jump into the wagon, but his mother pried his hands off the boards, crying, "Gego, Gego," and he fell down hard. But there was something in him that would not let her leave. He jumped up, and although he was wearing only light clothing, he ran behind the wagon over the packed drifts. The horses picked up speed. His chest was scorched with pain, and yet he pushed himself on. He'd never run so hard, so fast and furiously, but he was determined, and he refused to believe that the increasing distance between him and the wagon was real. He kept going until his throat closed, he saw red, and in the ice of the air his lungs shut. Then, as he fell onto the board hard snow, he raised his head. He watched the back of the wagon and the tiny figures of his mother and sister disappear, and something failed in him. Something broke. At that moment, he truly did not care if he was alive or dead. So when he saw the gray shapes, the shadows, the wolves bounding lightly from the trees to either side of the trail, far ahead, he was not afraid.
Louise Erdrich reading from The Painted Drum. The consequences of that ride through the forest and what subsequently happens to Anaquat and her children are what take up a lot of the next part of the book, and we will talk about that after this short break. You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
Thanks.
And you're listening to 98.7 WFMT and Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, as she just said, a monthly series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who have published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. Trader Joe's does things a little differently, because their customers hold them to a very high standard. Dan Bain says Trader Joe's works hard to live up to those high standards by traveling the world to bring you exciting, exotic products, as well as basics such as milk, eggs, and butter, all at the very best prices every day. They also believe a satisfying shopping experience is more than good products. They want you to enjoy shopping at Trader Joe's. The upbeat crew members and samples of wonderful food are served so you'll come back often and bring your family and friends. And how's this for unique? They're so confident you'll be happy with Trader Joe's products, they even have a distinctive guarantee. They've tried it and they've liked it, but if you don't, bring it back for a full refund, no questions asked. To find your neighborhood Trader Joe's, call 1-800-SHOP-TJ's. That's 1-800-SHOP-TJ's. Ico's Art Materials asks, how can the traditions of an ancient culture exist and even grow in today's world? The answer may be in two new books. Building the Japanese House Today follows the construction of a Japanese-style guesthouse in California. And Inspired Shapes, Contemporary Designs for Japan's Ancient Crafts, details 50 objects made by artisans melding new ideas to traditional techniques. Ico's Art Materials, for beautiful Japanese paper and fine handcrafted items to inspire and delight, at 3347 North Clark Street in Chicago. Phone 773-404-5600. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A in Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place once a month, Sundays at noon at the Looking Glass Theater. You can be in the audience for the next broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman on Sunday, November 20th, when Victoria's guest will be Frank McCourt. Admission is free. Just call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
Welcome back to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. My guest is Louise Erdrich. We're talking about her new 10th novel, The Painted Drum. You remember Love Medicine, The Beat Queen, The Master Butcher's Singing Club. One of my favorites was The Last Report of the Miracles at Little No Horse. Anyway, the list is so long I can't even go into them. But there's poetry, children's books, nonfiction, collaborative works. And she's got all these kids. She's got children up the wazoo. And I can't even like understand how you do all of this. But I'm going to ask you about that in a little while. But first, when you just read the last section, the consequences of parents' irresponsibility and the children in this book having to rise to these sacrifices and the bravery. I mean, you see that as the dominant theme, and it is. There's nobody who is unscarred in this book, who hasn't lost a child, a parent, a sibling. And yes, it's mainly girls, although Bernard himself was a pretty important son at one point,
right,
and brother to his children.
Right.
I know that you were the eldest of seven children, and I keep thinking, well, you must have had to take care of a lot of your siblings, too, as the oldest child. Your parents didn't sound particularly flawed. They sound unusual. Your father writing his you know, limericks about every town in North Dakota. And you do describe yourself in something I read as your family being the town oddballs at one point.
At one point. Now we're oddballs, you know, if you last long enough, you become fixtures and everybody likes you in a small town. It's great. But I was very fortunate because I have and still have very wonderful parents, very supportive, interested parents, and very interesting, too. So the, you know, the sacrifices and the reason I think this is part of the book is that as an older sister, I was terrified something would happen to my brothers and sisters, and things always nearly did. It was one of, you know, it was a big family, so we were always sort of right on the edge of some disaster or the next. So there's a kind of, and as well having my daughters, I see so much such generosity from child to child. I mean, I know there's a lot that's written about the kids who backstab in junior high, you know, that kind of thing. But I also see among siblings, and it starts early, and it's not like it's a perfect relationship, but it's an incredible concern, a very different kind of love, and often it's a self-sacrificing kind of love. And as we get older, we begin to treasure that more with each other, I think. And so I wanted to write about that.
The timing of this book is sort of interesting, and the fact that it does take place, a great deal of it, in New Hampshire, where you lived after attending Dartmouth. You were one of the first women that attended Dartmouth. You were kind of a trailblazer in a lot of ways.
Unknowingly. I didn't even know. I came out from North Dakota. I hadn't really left. My mother saw this picture in a National Geographic and thought, they've got great ice sculptures, you know. They had a nice, you know, so I went out there, and I didn't know it was the first year, and that was the first year for Native students as
you
well.
You didn't know that when you applied?
I really didn't know. I didn't know anything about the place.
Except they had ice sculptures?
Pretty much.
Interesting but, choice.
You know, yeah, it
was. Got you in, I guess.
I learned a lot more quickly, yeah.
Well, and you have talked about New Hampshire as being the place where you originally started to learn Ojibwemoan.
Right. I started learning from tapes.
Because you felt so distanced from where you had grown up.
I did. I was very homesick, yeah.
To go back to that place now was also the place that you were married to the founder of the what was it called?
The Native American Studies program at Dartmouth, right.
And to talk about children being brave, your kids had to be incredibly brave.
Oh, they are.
And they continue to be when their father committed suicide in 1997. Don't want to go into it particularly. But I know that we need distance from important events. And this, to me, in many ways, seems like the book that is somehow coming to terms with some of what went on in your family.
It could be, although I think that all of the books in some way come to terms with a writer's life in cycles that are unpredictable. And this I didn't see as being a particular reference back. But I'd started it in 1989. So I started it long ago. You know,
Which part did you start then?
The part in New Hampshire. You know, I'd written about this couple of kids on the road, and the layers of the book came together slowly over time. I mean, I usually will have a piece that maybe 20 years go by before I'll use it. So I keep things kind of interwoven. I've got three books maybe going at a time. And then I don't have that desolate emptiness when I finish one. I always have something I'm looking forward to returning to.
And that's why we see characters reappearing. Although in this book, they're much more muted in the background. In your other books, we see, you know, Fleur, although she figures
she's
very prominently
in this. She's in this one, right.
And even Tatro, the whole Tatro clan has come up before. But this book seems so much more contemporary in the way that you approach it. That
it is more, right. With a character my age, with a relationship that was very hard for me to write. And relationships are hard to write. I don't know how other writers do them.
I mean, God, the passion in your books, there's always like something that's really, whoa, heated going on. So if it's hard for you, you do a good job covering it up. Why was that one particularly hard?
I think it was because I had them having conversations as in real life. You know, so much of the book deals with myth or with the past or with the past intruding on the present. And here I had two people face to face who had to try and form a relationship when they're dealing with grief and buried grief, immediate grief on one side, buried grief on the other. And grief is it's a very explosive subject in a relationship because you never know how anyone has dealt with grief. And we all have it. We all have some form. But people are so wildly varied in where they put it and how it manifests itself later on.
Well, their relationship is one of the things that ends up being kind of redeemed at the end. I mean, there is redemption.
Oh, good. There is redemption.
There is. It's not all death, murder, mayhem. There's definite redemption. And actually, one of my favorite characters, there were two, but one is really, he's like the most unlikely hero rescuer, which is this fellow Morris. He's just such a great
Ingen, yeah, the wolf.
The wolf.
Yeah.
And this man, it enters into another one of the contemporary stories, the last part of the book, where we are once again on a reservation, but in like now, it's now, it's taking place at this moment. And once again, with some children, a group of kids who have to be incredibly brave. And the older daughter, Shawnee, I mean, the description of these kids trying to stay alive in their house in the middle of freezing weather while their mother is off in town trying to get money together to buy food and fuel. The mother, Ira, unusual name for a woman there. Mm-hmm. Or is it Ira? You pronounce it Ira?
Does it really? I pronounce it Ira.
Okay, that's how I did.
That sounds kind of nice.
These kids eating toothpaste and finding crumbs that might be bugs. How the drum rescues them, and then how this character, Morris, seems to be the rescuer of Ira, mm-hmm. I thought was really great, that people are flawed, but they can survive, and they can find hopefulness at the end of these terrible things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people don't have to be perfect to rescue each other. You know, that's one of the things that is a very human truth, I think. And this situation that the kids find themselves in, they're alone in a house. Their mother has gone to town to try and get food and heating fuel, and their time is running out. They just have nothing. They've eaten everything, and they're looking through the house. That is something that, in fact, I carry something with me all the time that a person gave me who had gone deaf because he was left alone in a cold building as a little kid. And I've never forgotten this person, you know. So sometimes, I mean, I imagine what it must have been like for him. But this is where the stories come from, little bits and pieces of life that fall my way, I suppose.
And then you cobble them together, sew them together into a quilt, and then it becomes a book.
Well, as a writer, you have to really then throw yourself into the situation and imagine each thing that each person would do. So it's not as though anybody will ever tell you the whole story, but you have to go after it and go into it. And, you know, the big thing, pretend, just pretend to be there.
But you've said how your characters surprise you. And I always wonder what that means. That are you just sitting there typing and all of a sudden something comes out of you actually are writing these in longhand, I think, first, aren't you?
Yeah, I write in longhand. I've never gotten that familiar with the computer. My daughters will tell you that I need help all the time. But I have now started writing them in books so that I like to have a handwritten book by the time I'm finished. It's nice to have it. And surprise. I don't know if maybe it's a little disingenuous to say they surprise me, but sometimes an idea will pop up that doesn't seem to fit that character. For instance, when this drum is stolen, that surprised me very much. I didn't know that would happen, but it did set into motion the entire series of events that makes up the rest of the book.
I love that they can be that spontaneous. Those of us who read these books, you know, we're seeing the finished product, and it seems like a fairly linear process. But even in my review copy of this book, the whole last couple pages were torn out. There was something X'd out, a poem that was at the end.
Oh, I know.
You
I
were
kept
writing this up to the last second.
To the last bitter moment. Now, Victoria, you would have received a reader's copy, which is the second to the final manuscript editing process. It shouldn't go out to reviewers, but it always does. You know,
I loved
and so
it.
Then
it
I kept
the
writing, and then it came back, and I thought, oh no, it's so different. And the publishing company, HarperCollins, had them find someone to X out pieces of it and cross out others.
It's great. I know it's going to be valuable one day. It'll be on eBay.
I'd sworn I would go to New York and do every one myself unless they found someone, so they didn't want me around.
We're going to take questions in a little while, which is why there are these microphones down here if people want to ask something to Louise Erdrich. But before that, you know, the component that people might not know about you is that you also, on top of all of this writing, this prodigious amount of work, these children that you have a really young child. She's what, five now?
Four and a half.
Yeah. You've got older children. And you've got a bookstore. So this wasn't enough. You thought, okay, in 2000... let's open a bookstore, 8,000 titles in 800 square feet, Birch Bark Books in Minneapolis. You didn't have enough to do? Needed more?
Right. I have the greatest time with this, and I don't work in it. I don't even manage it. We started it. I started it with my daughters, and we started renovating this dentist's office, which one of my daughters has pointed out. It was a really bad dentist's office. Why couldn't, you know, we should have actually started from something that was nice to begin with, but we started it from somewhere where we had to yank out tons of material, and we made this beautiful bookstore. And my daughters have worked there, all of them. It's a great project. It's great for, it's a focus for Native intellectual life in Minneapolis, which is why we wanted to start it. But it's also a general community neighborhood bookstore, and it's one of a dwindling number of independents. We're hanging in there. It's our fifth year. It's Birch Bark Books, and we're online.
And you started publishing books in Ojibwe. How come I can't say this?
Because it's not a regular, you know, Western language. It's
Ojibwemoan.
Ojibwemoan.
Ojibwemoan. Ojibwemoan. The reason this is interesting to me is that there are a lot of of words. You bring Ojibwe into the painted drum without translating, and we're sort of left to figure out pretty much what it is. And we can.
It's, I mean, from the context, right? It's pretty clear.
But it's still, you're obviously now feeling pretty confident about whatever ability you have in Ojibwe, which you didn't have, you know, back in New Hampshire when you were still listening to the tapes. And now you're publishing books. You've published two books in Ojibwe.
Not my books, because I speak at maybe the level of a 3-year-old, maybe. That's it. This language is in the Guinness Book of World Records as being so difficult that it's very few people who master it. And after the age of 50, you're just about doomed. But I still work on it all the time. And it's in the books because sometimes the words are just too beautiful to leave out, or they're too evocative. The meanings are all based on something very different than Western language. I mean, they all connect directly to a dream, a spirit, something else, something other. I'm not a terribly religious person, but in many ways this religion gets, or this spirituality infuses the language. So I really think studying the language is a form of spirituality.
Well, you've said it's an incredibly flexible language, that there are words for fax machines and email and computers.
Yeah.
It can evolve and absorb pretty much anything, although it's genderless.
Yes, I like that about it. It has no specific reference to gender. If you are using a verb, or if you're talking about a table or whatever in French, or what, it would always have a gender. And everything is a he or she. It doesn't really have a gender, but it has a livingness or a not livingness. It's not a deadness, but it's a not livingness. So
yeah, something like a stone would be living.
Right. A stone is alive. And once you start thinking that way, you begin to realize, you begin to look at the world in a slightly different way.
I have to say that I think people are totally intimidated and nobody's standing to ask questions.
So. Oh, are there question time?
Yeah, get up there.
Great.
Thank you. She's so imminently approachable and kind. Here, we have a gentleman coming up to ask Louise Erdrich a question.
I've been a part of a subcommittee of the Caxton Literary Society in Chicago, and we nominated you to be considered for the Nobel Prize. I must tell you that.
Oh.
I have lived at Red Lake, Minnesota for 2 years, and I vouch that what you describe is valid, true, and real. Do you view yourself like Faulkner, just describing people in an area, or do you view yourself also as a spokesperson for the Native American Indian? What is your role that you envision yourself?
I don't view myself as a spokesperson, first and foremost. I really see myself as a storyteller, and I reflect how people live, or what people tell me. Most of all, what they tell me they want written down. Many of these stories, people say, write it. And if they say they don't want it, I don't write it. But I am a quarter Ojibwe or Chippewa. My mother is French and Ojibwe. My dad is German. So I write from both sides of my experience, so that for me to say I have some special knowledge or some spokesperson type quality that would qualify me would be wrong. I don't. I'm a storyteller. But thanks.
We have another question here.
In Four Souls, the very first sentence that's written, even before the first chapter, is one of the most provocative sentences I've ever read. And it's, she threw out one soul and it came back hungry. And I'm wondering if you can talk about, when you created that, what meaning you were thinking of. Because as I am haunted by this, it has so many different meanings.
I think that I was talking about myself when I wrote that. You know, I think when a person comes to, say, a hard time, even in my younger days, there would be times when I thought I'd come to the end of my endurance for some reason. And I don't know why, but that image of throwing out one soul to survive. I felt like I had more than one soul, and I could throw it out. But this one, because it's Fleur's, it comes back hungry. You know, that just, I don't know why that came to me.
Another question here.
The really interesting thing about your work, as different from other authors, is that you're never really finished. I mean, you've gone back and revisited Fleur, and Revival Road won an O. Henry Prize as a short story, and then it shows up in this book. I wonder if you could tell me and us about how you as a writer, I mean, is your mind always working so that you're always going back to these stories, or do you ever say, okay, this book's done, I'm not going back to these characters? Because it seems like you don't.
I try to say that. I try to say it's done, I'm not going back. And they always show up. They always do show up. For instance, one of the books was about a priest who is actually a woman. And that's called The Last Report. And I had no idea that the priest I'd written before in a book called Tracks was female. But then I looked back and I saw that the description was very androgynous. He could well have been female. So I almost feel as though there's a subterranean story that I'm always, it's surfacing, it goes back under, it comes up, it goes back under, but that I have to stay with it because, and I don't mean to sound, you know, that I have some sort of mystical hotline or something, because I don't even have a cold feeling. It's just that I really feel that they're there somehow, that I have to stay and wait and keep after the story, and that the story will always bring some new facet back.
A lot of reviewers do begin their reviews of your work as describing you as a Native American author, and I'm wondering about two things, whether you like that description, which seems to me to anybody who's the term writer is prefaced by female writer, African-American writer. It's always somehow ghettoizing to me to do that. But I wonder if you feel that way yourself. And also, if the Native population that reads your book reads them differently, you think, or do you write thinking there are two separate audiences for these books?
I do think that Native people read them somewhat differently, especially Ojibwe people, will get a little bit more of the language or whatever else is sort of buried in the books. But I grew up seeing myself as a mixed blood. So there's a mixture. And I think everybody's a mixture, more or less. So that I see that what I write out of is experience and what draws me and what I feel compelled more than anything else to write. But I don't see myself in any particular category. I feel that the work has to be human to human. It has to be human being on the page and human being as the reader. And that's how it has to work. So the category is very useful for booksellers, I've found. It's an academic category. It allows people to create courses. And it sort of gives people a handle for what to read or where to put books. But I think, almost all writers now have something attached.
Yes, there's always a hook.
Yeah.
I guess before you go, I need to really understand how it is you were able to do all that. These books come out every couple of years. You're also writing articles, commentaries, you know, fascinating sort of sometimes political pieces like the thing you did in the New York Times about Leon Peltier. Mm-hmm. And yet you're not raising all of them now, but there are six children in your life, let's say. And that you're able to continue doing all of this with the bookstore, it just seems extraordinary, like an incredible feat that you're able to keep it going. And how do you do that? I mean, the kids obviously are really important and are there, but are you trotting upstairs and just typing things out constantly?
No. No, I spend a lot of time just trying to clean my kitchen and pet my dog. I don't know. I really think that persistence and building stories up a little bit at a time is the only way they seem to, they build up. I don't really know how they do it, because it seems to me sometimes I look, I haven't written for the longest time. I don't know how it happens, but I just keep at it. I never give up. I'm like that dog that keeps going after the rubber ball. I just don't give up.
There was a moment, I guess, back in, was it 94, you wrote an essay called A Woman's Work.
Right.
That showed a slightly different perspective of what you're doing. You sounded actively, like, depressed about, it was almost as though, what is it? It's like postpartum depression. It seemed almost like that. It sounded like it was really, really, really difficult. You talked about suicide then.
Mm-hmm.
But, and actually what you said was so poignant. I would kill myself, but I don't feel as though there is a self. I have to believe that was a very temporary. Yes, that is
then
a quote.
Then I said I wouldn't ever do it.
Right. Then you took it back. But
yeah,
that moment is obviously long past.
Oh, long past. You know, that was a very hard time. I was quite isolated from my family. And I was much younger, and I was in the middle of the woods with babies and my writing. But I also, it's interesting because I saw that book as so positive, you know. Realize everybody survives, you know.
In the
Blue Jays Dance.
Oh, you're talking about the Blue Jays Dance. Right,
go
right.
On, they leave, yes. You know, they start to walk, you know, and the writer keeps writing. So I'd always seen it as positive, but very intense, because I wrote it because I don't think enough is given to women to understand the overwhelming barrage of feelings that will come to us when we have children. It's very hard to anticipate.
Well, you pay homage to them in this book, and it's a wonderful one. Before we let Louise go, I do need to tell everybody that the next Writers on the Record is going to be on the 20th November, Frank McCourt. Get your tickets now, followed by James McManus on January 22nd. There'll be no live interview in December. Louise Erdrich, thank you so much.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you all for being here. Thank you. Great to see readers. Thank you.
You've been listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. A contributor to WTTW 11's Chicago Tonight and Artbeat, Victoria Lautman has written articles for the Chicago Tribune, USA Today, The Reader, and the Chicago Sun-Times. She's been the Chicago editor for Metropolitan Home, Art and Auction, and Architectural Record, and has also contributed pieces to many other magazines, including Interview, Elle Decor, and Architectural Digest. Writers on the Record will return on November 20th, when Victoria's guest will be Frank McCourt. That's Sunday, November 20th at noon, live from the Looking Glass Theater in the Water Tower Waterworks at 821 North Michigan Avenue. We invite you to tune in, or if you'd like to be in the audience, you may reserve a free ticket by phoning 312-832-6789. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Artistic Director David Caitlin, Executive Director Rachel Kraft, Production Manager Alex Blunt, Assistant Production Manager Erica Sandvig, and Sound Engineer Bob Gilmartin, and to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunas is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Carolyn Paulin is today's director. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. You're listening to 98.7 WFMT Chicago, a service of Network Chicago.